On May 8th, Mecklenburg voters will take to the polls to elect a sheriff. And one of the biggest issues up for debate is 287G. That's a program that allows Mecklenburg sheriff's deputies to work with federal immigration officials to screen and detain inmates. WFAE's FAQ City podcast wants to know, what questions do you have about 287G and immigration and deportation policies in the Charlotte region? Submit your questions now on WFAE.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Spring is in the air, but 10 years ago this month, a harsh winter was about to hit the economy. In March 2008, one of the first big dominoes fell in what would become the Great Recession.
And the bell has sounded, bringing to a close an extraordinary day on Wall Street. Bear Stearns today leading the tumble on Wall Street, the stock plunging 45% after the New York Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan agreed to provide an emergency financing to the Wall Street firm.
That Friday afternoon was part of what the Wall Street Journal called the 6 days that shook American capitalism. Not long after the Fed arranged a bailout of Bear Stearns, it forced the firm into a shotgun marriage with J.P. Morgan Chase. Within months, the collapse of Bear Stearns would be followed by Lehman Brothers' bankruptcy and Bank of America's acquisition of Merrill Lynch as the financial crisis hit one company after another. Watching all this unfold was Joseph Stiglitz, the 2001 Nobel Prize-winning economist who, it said, foresaw the crisis. You could say that clairvoyance was instilled in him as a young child in Gary, Indiana. The economic and societal inequality he witnessed at an early age caused him to become a doubter in the free market. Stiglitz says inequality is the reason he got into economics. His work has included time in the Clinton White House in the early 90s, where he served on the Council of Economic Advisors. He went on to serve as chief economist at the World Bank. Since 2001, the year he won his Nobel Prize, Stiglitz has been on the faculty at Columbia University. As I said, inequality has long been the foundation of Stiglitz's work. And earlier this month, he was in the area to speak at Davidson College about the inequality that continues to persist in the U.S., which he also spoke with me about in our studio. Joseph Stiglitz, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Nice to be here.
As I just mentioned, much of your work focuses on economic inequality, and you have certainly come to the right place in Charlotte. We've had philanthropists, business leaders, politicians have been shamed and embarrassed by the city's recent ranking dead last in a Harvard survey in terms of economic mobility. A task force last year found that segregation and lack of educational and healthcare opportunities are to blame. How do those kinds of problems here compare with what you see nationally?
Well, there are these patterns across the country and marked differences. The differences are actually geographically concentrated. You see much less mobility in the South and some parts of the Midwest. You see more mobility in places like San Francisco, San Diego. I think it's partly a function of the extent to which there are new industries, people coming in, the places where there are deindustrialization are places where there is less upper mobility. It's almost obvious that they're going to be having trouble. I think one of the ways of understanding what is going on is that when the industries were looking for good places to locate, given that America has a reasonably good transportation system, one of the things that they focused on were where are the places with low wages. Now, one of the things about low wages is it's a sign of market dysfunction. When markets are working well, everybody would get the same wage. If the wage were low, you'd move somewhere else. But if there are some barriers to mobility, people who don't have the resources to move or are networked to their family and don't want to move, those are places where wages are low. Those are places that attracted industry 30, 40 years ago. And now, with deindustrialization, these are the same places where the problems of immobility remain.
You've been highly critical
of President Trump. You're known as a left-leaning or liberal economist, I should say. I'm wondering, how do you convince Republicans and more conservative voters and politicians to listen to your views on how to make the economy more equitable?
I think the issue is first to make people aware of the degree of inequality, and that, in fact, most of them unknowingly are being affected. So if you look at the data, for instance, you look at a chart which shows what's happened to the average income of the bottom 90% over the last 40 years, it's basically stagnated. The GDP has gone up. There's been growth, but it's all gone to the top 10%, mostly the top 1%, and a large fraction, the top 0.1%. So whether they like it or not, they're involved in this inequality. Another statistic I think that conveys the extent of inequality in the United States is that in spite of the fact that we've had GDP going up, growth in the economy, the median income, that means half above, half below, of a full-time male worker adjusted for inflation today is at the same level that it was 42 years ago. Now, that's a startling statistic. And if you want to understand why there's a lot of discontent, particularly among men, I think that statistic gives you a feeling for why that is the case. And remember, these were the lucky guys. These are the lucky guys who have a full-time job. And if you included those who don't have a full-time job, the numbers would be much, much worse.
I was going to say, one of the interesting things along those lines, reading some of your work, is you talk about how when you have the haves and have-nots and the gap keeps getting wider and wider, one of the perils is that for the people in the top 10% or the top 1%, they begin to lose empathy and the idea of common good. And I'm just wondering if you could expound a little bit on that.
Yeah, that's a very important concept that we as a society have to do a lot of things together. In times of war, we fight together. But in times of peace, we have to come together to make decisions about constructing roads, investments in technology, education, health. I mean, all the things that we as a society in one way or another do together. And we sometimes forget that while the private sector does a very good job in bringing goods to market, most of the research on which they are resting is done publicly. And if there isn't a sense of common good, you won't have the support for that basic foundations on which all of our progress rests. So when there is not that kind of empathy, the kind of when they live in separate worlds, the ability to find common cause, which is so necessary to make a modern economy work, you won't be able to find it. Contrast is, if we were a primitive agriculture economy like 200 years ago, what I do on my farm wouldn't have much different to do with what you do on your little farm. And I could have a big farm, you could have a little farm, and we just go ahead and do what we want to do. It's not so in our closely integrated economy. And where this becomes particularly problematic is when it comes to things like education and health. The very rich can get the quality of health care and the quality of education for their children that they want. But meanwhile, most Americans won't be getting the quality in education and the quality of health care that would lead them to live up to their potential. And that's one of the reasons that what we see today in standardized test scores, comparing the performance of American students with those in other countries, we are mediocre. So we like to think of America as number one, but we have to face it. in this world where education is going to make a difference and who's going to be discovering the big new innovations, who's going to be, have a competitive advantage, we are mediocre.
That is the tough medicine coming from Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, who is joining us today. By the way, I should say that the way to get a Nobel Prize-winning economist to stop by is to have your studio located on John Maynard Keynes Drive. So, yeah, that sold you, didn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to ask you, Charlotte, as you probably know, is a large financial center, third largest banking center in the United States. Bank of America has its headquarters here. Wells Fargo has its East Coast hub here. And you write a lot and analyze a lot the problems with our financial system, particularly with financial companies. What are some of the more obvious problems that you are concerned with right now with the notion of these too-big-to-fail companies?
The problem with too-big-to-fail companies is they know that they're engaged on a one-sided bet. If they take on a lot of risk and things turn out well, they make a lot of profits. If things turn out not so well, because they're too big to fail, the government will come to the rescue. So the government, in effect, has taken away the downside risk. Dodd-Frank, the bill that was passed in 2010 to deal with some of the problems that have been clearly revealed by the 2008 crisis, laid out a framework that was supposed to inhibit the government rescue. I'm not convinced that it's going to work. The problem is that in a crisis, people panic. And government, president, is not a financial expert in most cases. In fact, I haven't seen anyone that's a financial expert. And they turned to the financial experts. What are the financial experts going to say? You can't let it fall. It will be the end of the world. It'll be the end of the financial sector. And that's exactly what happened in 2008. You know, we did have bankruptcy laws. Mm-hmm. We did have laws that said that when a bank can't pay what it's owed, the bondholders become the equity. That's a normal way to do it. And only in the last recourse, where there still isn't enough money, should the government step in. But that's not the way it played out. The government stepped in with a massive $700 billion bailout. And actually, the full amount of the bailout was larger because the Fed itself, which is essentially a government institution, was feeding money to these banks. So we saw in 2008, we didn't play by the rules of capitalism. And I am unconvinced that Dodd-Frank, the 2010 bill, has resolved that. I think the only way to resolve it is to break up the too-big-to-fail banks. The smaller banks, we did let fail. Several hundred of them we let fail. It was the big banks that were saved. And there's one more problem that with the too-big-to-fail banks. Because they're too big to fail, they get access to capital at a lower cost. And that means they get to grow bigger and bigger. So the system is totally distorted. You succeed not on the basis of greater efficiency or greater service to your customers. You succeed on the basis of a larger guarantee from the U.S. government.
That's Joseph Stiglitz. He is our guest this hour. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. We're going to take a break and come back and talk a little bit more about the banking system and how it affects Charlotte and the larger economy right here on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg, I'm in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Joseph Stiglitz. He is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, a professor at Columbia University, and a man about all economic matters, including, as we were just discussing, the banks and some of the notion of too big to fail. I wanted to ask you, when you were talking about, you know, this idea of the small banks were allowed to fail— and the government stepped in and saved larger institutions. Are you saying that it would have been better to just let some of those larger institutions that were in trouble fall by the wayside if they had to?
No, I wasn't saying that they should fall by the wayside. We did a little bit of an experiment in that with Lehman Brothers, and that didn't work out so well.
Okay,
so
just clarifying.
The point is, when you have these big institutions, you just can't let them collapse. You know, it was a mistake to allow them to get that big, but what you do is you proceed with the usual rules of bankruptcy and conservatorship is what it's called in banking. And what you do is you say the bank is going to continue. The shareholders are going to be wiped out and the bondholders become the new shareholders. Okay. And so the bank continues. You don't shut down the bank. It's just that the shareholders lose their value. And
you have a new set of constraints, obviously, on the entity that survives.
That's right. And now, since you don't have to pay the bondholders, you have a lot more money to meet your other obligations, like your depositors. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Citibank, for instance, there were over $300 billion of debt. Mm-hmm. And converting that into equity meant that all the obligations that you had on that $300 billion of debt get wiped out. No payments to those unless there's adequate funds. Mm-hmm. And I say only in the extreme case where even after you eliminate all the payments to the bondholders and all the payments to the shareholders, there is still a hole, then the government steps in, and that's where the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation comes in with their insurance policy. Right. Then the government has to take it over, and there are, again, well-defined procedures that many other countries have followed. Mm. And what typically happens then, the government injects money, which it did through TARP in this case, and it reorganizes the bank. You put new leadership. Obviously, the old leadership hadn't done a very good job. And typically, within a year, 2 years, you sell the bank back to the private sector. And so we sometimes call that temporary nationalization, or pre-privatization. But the point is, it's a matter of last resort. Normally, it's just an usual sort of procedure where the bondholders become the shareholders, but you don't let the banking institution fail.
Here we with Bank of America, and Bank of America certainly wasn't alone. But during the recession and afterwards, they were under a lot of scrutiny, various investigations. They paid a number of fines for violations of various rules and laws. And now we fast forward to the present, and it's sort of become Wells Fargo's turn. And I say that in terms of Bank of America and Wells Fargo are the two big pillars here. So we have the sham accounts, the unauthorized mortgage adjustments, and so on. And that's a long lead-in into Senator Elizabeth Warren has several times, including within the past few days, called for the CEO of Wells Fargo to be fired. And I'm just wondering what you think of that kind of activism. Should political leaders be not dictating but calling for this CEO or that CEO to be removed?
I think what has happened is a regulatory failure. The Federal Reserve has powers to remove the members of the board and certainly to put pressure on bank officials who are not doing their job. And because the Federal Reserve is so, you might say, cognitively captured, so influenced by the financial sector, it often has not fulfilled its job. Interestingly, it was only in the case of Wells Fargo that they put pressure on board members to resign. It's been the only case that I can remember that's ever been done, when it should have been done in many other cases. So what I do think is appropriate for people in the political sphere to say to the regulators, we passed laws to say that you have a responsibility to regulate. You know, we don't want to get directly involved. But on the other hand, let's be clear, there is a public purpose here. We wanted you regulators to take a strong position when there is that kind of abusive practice persistently. You know, once people make mistakes, but when there is a pattern like this.
Millions of accounts.
Millions of accounts. And then what is so striking about Wells Fargo is they come clean and said, oh, we did this very bad. And then a couple months later, you discovered a whole other set of misbehaviors that you didn't know about at the beginning. And you say, look, you haven't come clean. And either you are lying to us or you don't know what's going on. But either way,
the answer's not good.
The answer's not good. And either way, you are obviously not up to the task. You were willing to take a $10 million, $15 million, $20 million bonus for when the profits came in. But now suddenly, when things are not going so well, you say, I didn't have anything to do with it. Well, are you running the company or you're not? And you can't say I'm running the company when there are profits. But by the way, when those profits were generated by bad behavior, I had nothing to do with it. So I think it's very clear in the case of Wells Fargo, what you hear from reports is that they put pressure to engage in activities that you might say they knowingly close their eyes is the best way of perhaps putting it. So when there are these patterns, the regulators should be taking stronger actions. And I think what the politicians are saying is that if you aren't going to enforce the regulations in the way that we intended them to be enforced, we're going to have to pass new laws. And in this Republican bank-controlled Congress, it may be very difficult, but it's a warning. Our political system moves from Republican control to Democratic control and back again. And there is a lot of concern about this kind of misbehavior. And I think it's a strong warning that if the regulators under the current regulations, regulatory framework, aren't going to do their job, we'll have to take stronger actions.
You're hearing the voice of Joseph Stiglitz. He's a Nobel Prize winning economist. His latest book is Globalization and Its Discontents Revisited, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump, and he is a professor at Columbia University. When we, during that answer, you just mentioned bonuses, and I want to expand beyond just the banks. When we talk about corporate America, one of the things that is a recurring theme in your work is this idea that CEOs and other executives are paid, compensated, receive large bonuses based on stock performance. And one of the things you point out, for example, is, okay, if I'm the CEO of American Airlines and the price of oil goes down and my airline's profits go up, I didn't really do anything, but yet I'm going to get a handsome bonus. So that seems very logical to me. And my question is, why has that not resonated more, or why have the masses, so to speak, not been able to get the standards to reflect more of a comparative compensation than the ridiculous example I just gave you?
That's a very good question. I've been raising this issue now for, I would say, 30 years. It's very disturbing to me. I hear from CEOs when I talk to them and, you know, they talk to the press. We say we need incentives. And I can understand that. I'm not totally persuaded, because if you're paying a doctor, say a heart surgeon, you don't go up to your heart surgeon and say, by the way, I'll pay you $20,000 if I survive and $10,000 if I don't. You would be insulted. The surgeon would be insulted. He's going to put all his effort to make sure you survive. He's a professional. Now, when I turn over a company to a CEO, he should be a professional. He's a professional executive. He's acting, you might say, in a fiduciary capacity. He is responsible for the thousands of people who work for the company. He should be doing what he can to make sure the company prospers as much as it can. And to me, to say I'm going to pay you $5 million, and then for him to say back to me, but if you want me to get off the golf course, you'll have to pay me another bonus if we do well. I think in a normal world, you'd say to that guy, I don't want you. And yet this has become the norm among the CEOs, that you get this extra money for getting off the golf course. Now, to me, equally disturbing is that then I say to them, but the way you design your incentive system doesn't really provide you the right incentives. It provides incentives for you to monkey around with your accounting system, as we saw in WorldCom and so many of the other cases, to make it look like you're doing good, but you get bonuses when you don't deserve it. And you don't get punished when you do deserve it. Like the bank officials, mm-hmm. when the banks went down, many of them retained their bonuses. They were so embarrassed about calling it a performance bonus that they changed the name to retention bonus. But why would you want to retain somebody who had brought the company to the brink of ruin? So to me, it shows, it's an example of what I call power in the boardroom, power in the corporate sphere, that the CEOs are basically dictating their own pay. And they point the board of directors. The board of directors then award them the bonuses. And we have very weak control systems on this, what I call dysfunctional corporate America.
And on a related note, in terms of all of us, or maybe not you, because you understand economics a lot better than most of us do, but for the layman, whether it's people who are reporters like myself or people who are just, you know, sort of going on day-to-day life, I'm wondering, when we talk about the stock market in particular, when we talk about unemployment rates, and I think you're skeptical on both of those being used as the barometers of the health of our economy. How did we get to this point, though, where we're essentially programmed to think about the stock market and unemployment, and that's really all that matters?
Well, I think one of the reasons the stock market gets the attention is it's so exciting. It goes up, it goes down. It's like
keeping score.
It's like keeping, exactly. It's like a sports game. And it has an addictive character that what's going to happen tomorrow. And what many people don't understand is that there is a fundamental disconnect between the stock market and what's happening to the economy. Let me just give you two examples. When wages are low, ordinary people are not doing very well. Profits are high, and stock markets go up. Well, is it a good thing that wages are low and people are suffering? I don't think so. Another example, the economy is going into a recession. Interest rates go down very low. With interest rates low, nobody wants to hold a bond. They take their money and they put it in the stock market. The stocks go up. That's a sign that the economy is sick, not that the economy is well. A third example, many people don't realize that a significant fraction of the profits of American companies occur in China and elsewhere. So the stock market going up could be a consequence of what is happening in China or movements in the exchange rate. Nothing to do with how well they, as ordinary citizens, are going to be doing. So I think the stock market is a particularly bad indicator of how well the economy is doing. And of course, sometimes it moves with the economy. You know, if there's a boom and profits are high because of the boom, then it's a good sign. Mm-hmm. But too often you see all these kinds of perverse movements when unemployment comes down, which normally would be a good thing. People get worried that the interest rate is going to go up and the stock market goes down. So it moves often perversely to the direction of what we would say is the fundamental health of the economy.
What about unemployment now is 4% that is being, you know, touted every month when we get the jobs report. What do you think the true importance of that unemployment number is in our broader economy?
Right now, it is a number that doesn't really convey how well the labor market is doing. Let me say, in general, a lower unemployment rate is better than a higher unemployment rate. So that's true. But the question is it right to compare a 4.1% unemployment today with a number that we might have had 30 years ago, 25 years ago? And I think the answer is no. And two reasons for this. One of the striking things about America today is the low labor force participation rate. A lot of Americans have given up looking for a job. And the curious way we collect our numbers is that if you are not working, but you have been so discouraged that you stopped looking for a job, you're not called unemployed. But obviously you're not employed. And you really would like a job, but it just doesn't pay to search anymore. Well, you're no longer, you're not called unemployed. So we have, as I say, the ratio of people actually working relative to the working age population in the United States is very low compared both to our history and to what characterizes other countries. And one of the ways this, what I would call weak labor market, shows up is that real wages are not doing very well.
Let's hold it there and we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about that. We'll talk about taxes and steel tariffs when we continue with Joseph Stiglitz here on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and Joseph Stiglitz is my guest. He is the Nobel Prize winning economist, Columbia University professor, and all-around expert on matters of income inequality, economic inequality, which we've been talking about a lot today, and also how we measure the success of our economy. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is Charlotte is the home of Nucor Steel, and obviously the president's steel and aluminum tariffs have made big news lately. You were one of, I believe, 15 economists who had worked in both Republican and Democratic administrations who had come out in a letter and said this is not a good idea. The president later included some carve-outs, if you will, with Mexico and Canada, I believe. So what do you make of this tariff? I know you think it's a bad idea, but what do you think the ultimate impact of it is going to be?
I think we really don't know, because what we don't know is how much the carve-outs are going to be. Ironically, the way the president is going about doing the carve-outs is undermining the argument he made for the tariffs in the first place. He said there's a matter of national security, but somehow this national security is been put second place if you negotiate a good trade deal with us. And that I feel a little bit uncomfortable to say, if you do a good trade deal with us, you give us buy a few more of our cars or something like that, we'll put national security to the side. Now, of course, the real issue is there isn't a national security issue. Everybody who's looked at this issue says that's bogus. If what seems to be going happens, that we say, oh, we're not going to do this with our allies because that doesn't make any sense, and we focus on what most people allege to be the source of the problem, excess capacity of China in steel, China only exports we only import about 2% of our imports from China. So that will have no effect on the global steel market. Ironically, China over the last year and a half has cut back its production of steel enormously. And prices of steel have come up. The steel producers last year made several billion dollars of profits. They're not in the dire straits that they were a couple years ago. And it reminds me of so many instances where the president gets something bug in his mind and it's a world of the past and he's operating on a vision of the world of the past. So he talked about Mexicans coming across the border. By the time 2016 came along, there were almost no Mexicans coming across the border. It was no longer an issue, but he was fighting an old battle. He talks about currency manipulation by China, and that was a problem in the past. But by the time he talked about it, China was actually doing what it could to keep the exchange rate high, not low, and we were benefiting from it. So he often gets a bee in his bonnet at the wrong time.
It seems like the steel tariffs in particular tie into another bee that has been in his bonnet for a long time, which is he is very focused on the trade deficit with China. And I'm wondering, all this talk about trade deficits, how important is a trade deficit with China or for that matter, any country, in comparison to our overall economic performance?
Well, almost all economists agree on the following proposition, that a trade deficit with a particular country is not important. It is the total trade deficit, multinational.
Okay.
Multilateral. And that number is determined by macroeconomics. That number is determined by the gap between our domestic savings and our domestic investment. And Trump's policy, his tax cut for the billionaires and for the corporations.
Mm-hmm. The $1.5 trillion tax cut that was passed in December.
That led to this huge increase in the deficit of one. Estimated between one and two or even more trillion dollars, has the effect of increasing the trade deficit. And you notice in 2017, the first year the president was in office, the trade deficit actually increased. And it will increase even more as a result of that tax bill that he was so proud of. So that is the driver of the trade deficit. And we, if we don't import textiles or apparel from China, we'll import it from Bangladesh or Laos or some other country. And unless you're willing to say, Americans, you're going to have to pay twice as much for your clothes, and we're going to go back to primitive world autarky, where we are dependent on ourselves. Let's face it, the bilateral trade deficits just are second-order importance.
Again, I'm speaking with Joseph Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. One of the things that is a persistent theme through your work, including your new book, Globalization and Its Discontents Revisited, is this idea that globalization, in fact, has worked exactly as intended, and that the problem is the intentions were misguided. Explain that a little bit, and also explain what you think could correct these inequalities.
One of the intentions of globalization, from the perspective of corporate America, was to get lower wages. Lower wages either abroad or competition with abroad, forcing down wages or at least stopping wages from increasing here in America. And it worked. It was a ploy by which corporations could save money. A little bit, you might say, trickled down to consumers. Prices got lower. But much of it went to higher profits for corporations. And so globalization is one of the factors that have contributed significantly to the increase in inequality. We could have managed globalization very differently. For instance, one of the important things that we could and should have done is to say those who lose jobs will help you get another job. And that kind of trade adjustment assistance was something that Democrats asked for, demanded, but they didn't have the political power to get it through. And when they got it through, it was underfunded. Other countries that have managed globalization better have taken the view, look, we're democracies. Globalization is supposed to make our country as a whole better, but globalization will have winners and losers. And if there are a lot of losers, as has been the case in the United States, there won't be support for globalization. So they've realized this political economy, as we said, and they said an explicit part of globalization is a program to make sure that there aren't losers. And that's the approach taken by, for instance, the Scandinavian states. And that's why these countries are actually very open and very open to globalization, and very open to new technologies, because everybody, or almost everybody, is a winner. Now, the strategy taken by corporate America was a very short-run strategy. They said, we want low wages, so we don't want any programs that help workers, because we actually benefit from high unemployment, because that keeps wages down. And so that enhanced their corporate profits in the short run. But we are now seeing the consequences of that. This huge anti-globalization movement, which really threatens the business model of corporate America today.
You are obviously, as I said, you're very much a left-leaning economist. You are.
No, I don't view myself as a left-leaning. I think of myself as a centrist economist.
Okay, you're
a centrist. And I'm trying to stop the far right from destroying capitalism as we know it.
Okay, let me restate. You are definitely not a fan of supply-side economics, which it comes out of the Reagan era, this idea that the more you cut taxes and regulations, the more businesses grow and the more everyone benefits, the sort of trickle-down economics. That said, what do you think? You worked for President Clinton, as I mentioned, with the Council of Economic Advisors. There were two terms with President Obama, another Democrat. What did the Democrats miss economically in recent presidential administrations?
I think they missed paying attention to the large numbers of people who weren't doing very well. This was an issue that during Clinton's administration, both Bob Reich and I were in the cabinet together, kept emphasizing. When the financial crisis occurred, I told President Obama that it was important not just to save the banks, but to save the homeowners, and that you ought to think about trickle-up economics. Let's save ordinary Americans, do well by them, and build out the economy from the middle, and then everybody will benefit. Trickle-down economics has never worked. And earlier we were talking about how well the top 1% has done, top one-tenth of 1%. It didn't trickle down. As we pointed out, the vast majority of Americans have had near stagnation in their incomes. So we now should have known, we should know that trickle-down economics doesn't work, and another model is required. And I think there are two things they missed. The first is that they bought into a more humane version of trickle-down economics. They didn't They pushed for more trade assistance. They pushed for more assistance to those that were being left behind. But they didn't push hard enough, and there were too many people left behind. And the second thing is they did not realize the risk of financial market liberalization. And I strongly opposed the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
That's right, and, you did. I was yeah.
And when I was, as long as I was in the cabinet, it didn't happen. I thought it would not increase economic growth, but it would increase economic instability. And I think the evidence is overwhelmingly on my side.
And Glass-Steagall, for those who don't know, that was the separation of the investing aspect versus the traditional banking aspect.
Yeah, and the consequence of that was it led to ever bigger banks, mm-hmm. the problem of too big to bank, fail banks that we talked about, mm-hmm. but it also led to a culture of excessive risk-taking. It led the banks to engage in more and more of these nefarious activities, mm-hmm. Predatory lending, lots of the other mm-hmm. activities that have been uncovered in the last 10 years.
Another thing that you've written a lot about is this idea, particularly with globalization, that it has all been geared toward big business, in essence, but that people should try to imagine a version of globalization that is aimed toward the benefit of the workers, the masses. I'm wondering why, given the numbers involved, you think that a political leader or political movement has not emerged that pursues that.
I think this speaks to the way America's democracy works. Money matters, and money matters a lot. It was made much worse by Citizens United and a number of other Supreme Court decisions, which allowed corporations to give basically unfettered amounts of money, the PACs giving unfettered amounts of money. So we've moved to a system that I describe as closer to $1, one vote than one person, one vote. So when you have that kind of democracy, if you want to think of it that way, the corporations' voice is going to be heard a lot more. And they were focused on their short-run profits. And this is one of the, you might say, ironies. I said they were focused on their short-run profits. And the economic system that we've developed, capitalism, American style, is not even an efficient system because it focuses on the short run. The things that really lead to long-term growth are long-term investments in people and research and technology, education, and short-term markets, short-term financial markets, short-term corporations are not thinking that long term, and that was manifested in the way they approached globalization. So if they had approached globalization the way I would have approached it and say, look, globalization is making us richer. Well, let's make sure that there's nobody left behind. We share that. Maybe some people take a bigger share, but everybody is a winner. If they had approached it that way, we would not be having the anti-globalization movement that we are having today.
We'll have to leave it there. Fascinating thoughts from Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who has joined us. Mr. Stiglitz, thanks so much for being here.
Real pleasure.
I'm Eric Stanberg, in for Mike Collins. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlotte Talks.